Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. This week, people alongside the Kyrgyz and Tajik border were once again up in arms over a border dispute, which became a routine incident in that part of Central Asia. More than half of the 971 kilometers border still undefined in 70 disputed sites. The region remains as a flashpoint with nearly 16 such incidents last year and 20 incidents the year before. By comparison, the border tension between Kyrgyzstan in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan in Uzbekistan has significantly calmed down. So now the question is, how big of an issue is this becoming? How the nature of tension is evolving and what is the background of this all conflict about? To discuss this today, I'm joined by experts who have a lifetime experience studying this topic. From Dushanbe, Jafar Nemat Zoda is with us, who has just published a long research work on this very topic at the Central Asia program of George Washington University, where he was a research fellow until recently. From UK, we have Dr. Madeleine Reeves, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester. She's also author of the book on this topic called Border Work. From Moscow, we have Dr. Anna Matveeva, who's the senior visiting fellow at the King's College London. Like Madeleine, she has in-depth experience researching the border conflict in Central Asia. And from Prague, Bruce Panier is with us, who's the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlok Owazi. Bruce was on the Kyrgyz side of the border recently. So, Bruce, please set the scene for us. We have discussed the cross-border tension also a couple of months ago. Tell us, please, why we are back talking about this topic again.
You know, because especially in light of recent improvements along the Uzbek-Kyrgyz and Uzbek-Tajik borders, this Tajik-Kyrgyz border thing is really a glaring example of something that just doesn't seem to get any better. You know, they've been having problems there. Core of the problem, at least as I understood it when I was there a couple of years ago, seems to be that you have a lot of people that are out migrating, looking for work in Russia. And this was particularly true among the Kyrgyz population in places like Aksai and Koktash and places. And they leave and they have these informal like land sales. They'll sell off their land. And a lot of times people on the Tajik side of the border will buy it up. And of course, these contracts, I have a feeling, are worthless if you took them to either of the capitals. But for whatever reason, you know, the money's been exchanged. And then the new owner begins to build or expand their land into this other territory. In this case of what happened Monday, it seemed like it was actually a Kyrgyz woman who was extending her fence into what the Tajiks thought was their side of the property. But more traditionally, it's been because some Kyrgyz people decided they would pack up and leave for Russia, and they sold off to Tajik people right there by the border, and the Tajik people were the ones that were moving their fence or you know, grazing their animals or something on what the Kyrgyz considered to be their property.
Talking about this specific incident, Jafar, let's go to you. What are you hearing in Dushanbe about this latest development?
Well, in Dushanbe, you wouldn't really hear much about the incident because it is not politicized, if you wish.
But it is reported, obviously. It's heard people
Obviously, there are reports on the media about it, and mostly in the electronic media. It's not reported on the national TV or most of the radio stations, but of course it's reported on the electronic media.
Okay. Now, Madeleine, you know, as Bruce said, this isn't the first tension in that specific area. Why it keeps repeating?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think part of the answer really, we have to look really back to the Soviet period and to the land exchanges between what were then collective farms within the Soviet and Tajik republics, which meant that border in this region, in the Isfara Valley, remained in significant parts undelimited and undemarcated right up to the end of the Soviet Union. And then into the post-Soviet period, that lack of specificity, that lack of agreement over the precise location of the border has persisted. So I think that is part of the kind of bigger picture context that we need to take into account here. There's a long history here of disputes. There are recorded disputes going back as far as the 1930s, in the 1970s, at a time when there was significant population growth and the creation of new villages in this area. There were significant tensions over water, but also over land, and over the land that was under irrigation. And then in the contemporary period, that's kind of, I think, really escalated, particularly since the new millennium. So since around 2000, there were disputes in the 1980s and the 1990s. But I think that there are a number of reasons why these disputes have become perhaps more frequent in recent years, and also why they have become, in a sense, perhaps more politicized, or why local disputes, so in this case, you know, a dispute over somebody building a wall, right, in their garden plot, what are the contexts and what are the circumstances that mean that that relatively minor incident between two neighbors, say, very rapidly becomes an incident between two villages and two ethnic communities? And I think that's what we really need to be asking about, is those dynamics of escalation and how they have changed.
Jafar, as a Tajik citizen, you've been there a couple of times in the past. The same question what Madeline was raising. Now, like this one, for example, this time it appears to be that Kyrgyz citizen put a fence in the wrong side of the border that led to controversy, and controversy turned into tension, which quickly attracted around, I believe, 50 people from each side. Stones are thrown. It's relief that more lethal weapons are not used. Please visualize for us, how does the dispute start? How people quickly mobilize? Your research was focused on communication aspects, so please visualize the process it starts.
Who is going to talk?
I was suggesting that Anna would go first.
Maybe, Anna, you would like to start with this.
Well, my research is not really on communications. I have been working on that border for the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And also then, subsequently, as a researcher, I have published a long and very detailed article about development and causes and our current situation of what's happening on the border, including the conflict dynamic. As Madeline already mentioned, part of the reasons are to do with history, because both Kyrgyz and some groups of Tajiks have been resettled to the area. But some Tajiks have lived there historically, so they have different kind of historical claims to the land. That's why they use maps from different period. Tajik communities, for instance, use the maps of 1924 to claim legitimacy of their claims, and Kyrgyz side obviously uses the maps of the late Soviet period when the Soviet Union was falling apart. So that's one kind of conflicting narratives there, which became very politicized. The second reason is, I would say, establishment of the border itself. What previously would have been brawls between different villages or different families or school gangs or people who just don't like each other became interstate conflict almost. So we have a lot of people there, meaning law enforcement, police, and of course Kyrgyz communities are outnumbered. They feel very vulnerable because there are fewer of them than Tajiks. So they feel that they need law enforcement, security presence on their side much more. So they very much welcome troops. Tajik communities feel that it is something which is completely out of proportion. And thirdly, there have been history of incidents in the recent years, and people actually have died or for very small causes. So that created a lot of bitterness, which has not been there before. And that means that things which seemingly are very minor can get out of hand very quickly.
On the same topic, Jafar, if we can continue with you. So, yes, the claims are there. The sources of tension is, known. When it starts, how it starts, how people are mobilized, what happens?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, first, I think Anna has already sort of pointed out a very important aspect, the perceptions of local people of what the intentions or what the intention of the neighbor is. And that plays a very important role there. I would say many everyday issues that are occurring there, which you would find in any neighborhood, easily and quite quickly get framed in a specific language. Someone would put in ethnicity, someone would definitely put something else, and etc., etc. So I think the framing and how the incidents, quite petty and quite everyday incidents, get framed is very important. This is A. B, when we speak about mobilization, we have to understand that the social structure in those communities are very much, they have very strong group feeling. There is obviously a very strong feeling of loyalty to your own community. And there is a feeling that the community is sort of a first shield, a first defense against anything that can happen.
Interesting. Madeline, earlier we were talking about role of social media, the way this tension is reported. What were your points there?
What Jaffa said is very important in terms of these framing aspects and the fact that there already exists a narrative here about small incidents escalating, and that narrative becomes in a sense also then a framework for action. And I think then the social media plays into that perhaps in two key respects. One is that as part of that narrative, as part of that framing, and as part of that sense of vulnerability, and I think that's perhaps particularly marked on the Kyrgyz side because of the demographic differences that Anna has alluded to, there is a tendency, I think, very quickly to turn to social media and to social networks and to contacting also the mainstream media to report on these events. That I think now, as smartphones are much more prevalent in this region, there's a tendency to sort of record things, to upload them, to announce them on Facebook. And this is part of sort of logic of mobilization. And I think a second sort of aspect of how social media plays into and magnifies this also has to do with the broader context that Bruce alluded to right at the beginning, that this is a region where large numbers of young people, mostly men, but also particularly on the Kyrgyz side, women as well, are working away from the region. So they're working as migrant workers in Russia, typically, but also in Kazakhstan or in the respective capital cities. And so there's also a kind of a community that is invested emotionally, politically, legally, practically, economically, in what is happening in this region, who are not necessarily there at the time. And that, I think, can also become a sort of part of that dynamic and part of that context of framing. That very often the people who are, for instance, commenting on the videos of what is happening locally are people who are not necessarily right there in the Isfara Valley at the time. They might be people outside who are observing, but who know this region and who share that sense of group identity.
Mm-hmm. You know, the social.
Maybe I can also add to that, because now I'm in Russia, and of course, lots of Central Asian migrants around me. What is happening that sometimes people in the villages do not really know how to operate social media well. So what they do, they film the events and they put some kind of, you know, pictures together, and then they send it to their more internet savvy friends and relatives in Russia, who then eventually upload them on YouTube, and they kind of make it in a better picture, better tool, and that's how this virtual space is developing. Very interesting.
Yes, I would just add to that. I mean, I think it's also very striking with this particular incident that's happened this week. I would want to not kind of also take it out of proportion, in the sense that this is precisely the kind of incident, this sort of dispute that has occurred recurrently over the last few years. But it's, I think, only much more recently that these incidents reach the mainstream media and then become, you know, the object of commentary on podcasts like this.
Yeah.
So we also need to be very conscious of, you know, the role of these forms of broadcast in which we're participating in a sense, sort of magnifying the incidents, which is not to downplay the significance for people in the Isfara Valley of these acute senses of quite existential precariousness and uncertainty over water, over land, over the extent of the insecurity of the border, over harassment from border guards and so on. I mean, all of those are very, very real concerns. But I think the role of social media has had a really important role in a sense, magnifying and transmitting incidents that previously might not have registered beyond the local media.
Yeah, we are definitely sensitive to that. And just to put this in context, as this tension is not the new one, is there any change in the size of the crowd? Is there any change the way people express their anger when it happens?
I would say a couple of words, and I'm sure others perhaps would join. This is mostly young people who participate in these events. And they are, of course, easier to mobilize. Young people become much more conscious of their nation state and their ideology, which come with nationhood. Soviet generation is quite different. They have experience of living in one state and being a part of one kind of multi-ethnic community. So they have some more restraint. But kind of mentality of the younger people is changing. Just to give you one example, there was somebody on Tajik side who was an educated young man, quite feisty, who said to me, I'm not going to give up a molecule of my land. And that feeling is kind of becoming much more normal. It's not considered to be an extreme view.
Interesting. Brucey, the dynamic that Anna just has mentioned, what does this explain you about the future of this tension?
Obviously, the border looks different in different places. As you mentioned, it's more than 900 kilometers long. Now, there are places where the two communities are right on top of each other. I mean, literally, one side of the street is Tajikistan and the other side of the street is Kyrgyzstan when you're going down the road. Without any clearly defined border areas, I don't see how they're really going to get around this. And I suppose one example that I could give was if you're in Aksai, and that's how you get to Charku, Varuk. Okay, so I was going to Varuk, and my driver was Kyrgyz, and he stopped the car a couple hundred kilometers away from the entrance to Varuk and let me out and said, if you want to go, you got to go. And I said, why? And he said, because they'll throw rocks at my car and they'll break my window because they see the Kyrgyz plates. But I mean, so the tension is there. It's all the time. There's not a lot of arable land out there. You know, anyone that travels around through these areas knows there's rocky mountains and stuff. So if you can get a hold of something where you can grow crops or they keep farm animals or something, it means a lot to the people out there. With no clear definition of whose land that is, you're going to keep running into these problems all the time. I mean, the worst case scenario, the border guards were shooting it out, five or six years ago. And a couple of Kyrgyz guys got killed, included mortar rounds going across the border. Yeah. And another problem is every time this happens, the first thing that people want to do, well, what they have to do inevitably to calm things down is to call officials from the bigger cities, which means someone has to come from Batken and someone has to come from Isfahan. It's not, you can't get there in just a couple minutes, you know, to calm things down. So the two communities are going to have to figure out how they can get along together, because I don't see how the governments of the two countries can really do anything to help them out.
It's nice of you that you touched the government aspect of that. You know, when you were talking, I was wondering, when the tension happens, I believe this happens without the approval of the local authorities. Isn't it the way it happens?
Not always. That's not true.
So
sometimes there are, I won't name any names, but certainly on the Kyrgyz side of the border, there is a person I can think of who I spoke with, and they have mobilized their own community as soon as the word breaks out to go and participate in rock fights or whatever they're doing with the Tajiks.
Then the follow-up question that kind of raises is then how it comes that border guards are not getting involved in this fight against each other?
Well, there was several years ago, like I said.
In 2014, there was quite, I would say, significant tension between the border guards. I mean, my speculation there would be that the border guards in this situation are not seen as sort of somehow neutral arbiters of, you know, figures of the state who will be peacekeepers. I think they are seen by the local communities as, in a sense, part of the problem. And in this context of sort of a local instance that often mobilize incredibly quickly, I've seen this happen, you know, in Aksai and other villages, where it's literally, you know, people ringing each other up and saying, "Topalong Bashdalda," you know, the conflict started, come and join us. And so I think there can be issues of the border guards, you know, not reaching there in time. But I think there may also be a question of the border guards actually knowing that their presence might actually escalate things further rather than having a kind of a neutralizing effect.
Obviously, we have to move on, but just a very quick question. Maybe, Anna, you would like to take this. I think the most of the previous disputes have also emerged in this region close to Isfara Valley. Now, the question is, like, there are 70 disputed sites between Kyrgyz and Tajik border. Why is this region so tense?
Because these are lowlands, because it is very densely populated, because there is this, you know, big, rather large enclave of Varuh, which is surrounded by the mountains which belong to Kyrgyzstan, does not have an obvious territorial solution. And it is also because there was a series of tensions before, so people are kind of more ready to get mobilized, and they started to become, I would say, more entrenched in their positions, because I would say 20 years ago, there were kind of more readiness to try to find some kind of local solutions. Now it seemed to be, the idea is to separate the roads, to build fences as much as possible. And in that particular area, it's just physically not feasible.
Interesting. Okay.
Could I just add to that, Mohammed? I think that part of the particular reason why a lot of these tensions are found in the Isfara Valley also has to do with the way in which a lot of the infrastructure that has been built in this region, sometimes with, you know, international funding in part, has really served to reinforce livelihoods as separate from one another. So a moment ago, Bruce mentioned, you know, the Kyrgyz driver who stopped his car before entering Varuh because of a fear of people throwing stones. Now, I remember back in the early 2000s, there was a single bus that used to run from Batken to Varuh and go through all of the Kyrgyz and Tajik villages, kind of knitting these places together in a single infrastructural space. And now we have essentially sort of two separate road networks. And that has other kinds of effects. It means that people increasingly don't, for instance, trade at the same markets. Previously, you would have had Kyrgyz traders trading in Charku or Tajik traders trading in Samarkandek on the Kyrgyz side of the border. So you have this, in a sense, kind of increasing, I would say, nationalization of infrastructure and of space. So alongside the kind of the narratives that Anna alluded to, and I really agree with her there, the kind of the national narratives, I think there are far fewer opportunities now for young people and indeed for older people to meet in a very non-confrontational way, just in the kind of, you know, habitual run of daily life, right? Whether that was public transport, whether that was trading in the market and so on. And so I think that also undermines the kind of capacities that exist and existed within this region for a kind of durable, you know, forms of coexistence, because this region has always been short of water. This region has always had an insufficiency of irrigated land and so on. I mean, that's been an ongoing narrative throughout the 20th century. But I think what's happened more recently is that the kind of structures that would have served to mitigate tensions, the role of aksakals, so village elders, have also, I think, been really kind of undermined by a lot of initiatives aimed at securitizing this region. So it's also, I think, a kind of an object lesson in some of the unintended consequences of initiatives that may at one level be aimed at kind of improving connectivity in this region actually have a kind of opposite effect by leading to parallel lives.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you very much, Madeline. So 70 disputed sites, 519 kilometers out of 971 kilometers border undefined area. Why is that the border continue to remain source of dispute between these two nations after 25 years of their independence? What are the authorities think is the problem? What the people think is the problem, and what are the obstacles towards the solutions? So we will continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. In the light of the recent cross-border tension on the Kyrgyz-Tajik border, we are discussing the fundamental causes of the continued border dispute between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Joining me in the discussion are Dr. Madeline Reeves, Senior Lecturer of Social Anthropology at the University of Manchester, Dr. Anna Matviva, the Senior Visiting Fellow at the King's College London, Jafar Nemotsoda, Dushanbe-based a researcher with background in border disputes, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi, is with us. And I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. Now, the biggest question is, 25 years on, there are still 70 disputed sites on the Tajik-Kyrgyz border, 519 kilometers out of 971 kilometers border remains undefined. It appears that there hasn't been much of progress in resolving the issue over the past two decades. What is your take on this, Bruce?
Well, I suppose the easy but absolutely insufficient answer is that these places are far away from the capitals, but that is true about the borders anywhere in Central Asia. Why this particular area? Well, of course, as we know, it's mountainous, so this is already going to be open to all kinds of interpretation. No one wants the worthless mountain land at the expense of the great, very limited agricultural land that's there. You know, and these communities, I mean, before the Soviet Union came and drew any of these lines, I mean, these people wouldn't have recognized any boundary in the area at all. So this is a really hard situation for them where, you know, for generations, this wouldn't have made any difference. And you would have been walking back and forth, you know, and up one hillside and down the other and enter another community. And this wouldn't have been a very big deal, you know. But the governments, certainly in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, have a number of problems to deal with. There's no doubt about it. And what's happening in the hinterland, they leave pretty much to the discretion of the local officials in the area. You know, as I said a while ago, when these things hit on the border, when they occur on the Kyrgyz-Tajik border, people don't come from Dushanbe and Bishkek to settle this problem. They come from the nearest big cities to solve the problem. And of course, that's not really a solution. The two governments need to work this out satisfactorily to both sides, but they don't. You know, like I said, they're far away, and that's rarely on the list of priorities when they do get together.
Mm-hmm. Can I come back on that?
Yeah.
Because I see it somehow differently, because I have talked to both, you know, government representatives on both sides, and there is the so-called parity commission, intergovernmental commission, which is supposed to be sorting out these issues. Sometimes it's actually quite high level, on the level of the deputy prime ministers. So sometimes presidents have been involved and signed a joint declaration between Rahmon and Bakiyev, 2009. So yes, they want to solve it. I don't think that they see an obvious solution, but I think what's more important, that the border communities have an agency, and border communities are quite hostile to making any concession. The whole idea is that they should be making concessions, not us. So, and the government understand that they cannot solve this issue without making compromises, and they would be probably quite painful. And that's where the stumbling block is. Because, for instance, Uzbekistan under Karimov, far more authoritarian, again, difficult geography, but because of the nature of the regime, it could rein their communities in and nobody could raise a voice. Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are not like that. They sort of have to listen to people, not all the time, but in these instances, they have. And they feel that they cannot put too much pressure on the communities and need to take their views into account. For example, in 2013, I interviewed some high-level members of the authorities who claimed to me that they actually solved a piece of border, not there, not in Isfarai, a little bit in different area. But when I actually got to that area, it turned out that nothing was solved. So what happened? They agreed among themselves in the, you know, high-level corridors of power, but they didn't have enough courage to explain the agreement to the communities. And eventually nothing was done.
Could I just come in there? Because I think that's a very important point that Anna has raised. But I think there's also another factor, which is that if we ask why it is, in a sense, that the local communities often perhaps disregard, you know, a high-level agreement, I think it's also we need to really take into consideration the role of kind of popular memory in these border regions, which is very, very powerful and often kind of contradicts these, you know, official declarations. So there's a lot of discourse of, yes, you know, these officials maybe agreed something with some parity commission. There were, you know, repeated parity commissions in the 1940s and the 1960s. There was a parity commission in 1989 that was, in the end, its decisions were never ratified before the end of the Soviet Union. So there have been repeated parity commissions, but there's often locally a sense that these were sort of wheel dealings between officials. They were opaque. They didn't involve local communities. And so I think part of the reason that local communities perhaps don't feel invested in some of the high-level decisions that are being made is that they feel that their voice isn't being heard, that their perspective on, you know, memories of where land used to lie, who this land used to belong to, where they used to farm, where their ancestors used to have their graveyard and so on, that those perspectives aren't being taken into consideration. And I think that plays into then this dynamic where one of the ways where you get Bishkek to listen to you in these situations of tension is through sort of forms of local escalation. And it becomes a form of sort of a political modality for being heard in Bishkek. And I think it's one of the reasons as well why we see moments of escalation often correlating with times of political upheaval. More generally, certainly in Kyrgyzstan, but this becomes also a vehicle for kind of making political demands on Bishkek. So I think it's a two-way process. I don't think it's just a case of sort of officials in capital cities having the political will, but the local communities not having that political will. I think it's that very often local communities feel that they're absolutely not being heard by authorities in the capital cities.
Mm-hmm. In that regard, I know, Bruce, you want to say something. Like, what we can learn from the recent developments on the Uzbek-Tajik border, for example, I want to believe that the grievances that we are talking about here locally, that also existed on that border, but things are changing. How it is happening there, but the tension remains here on the other side.
Jafar? Okay, well, can I jump back a little bit and just building on what Anna and Madeline already said?
But I really
even
want
if
to
you
have
look technical.
I will
then move on to the Tajik-Uzbek developments and why is it not happening on Tajik-Kyrgyz side. Even if you look at it technically, one of the suggestions that were always on the agenda of those parity commissions, and I think it's still on, is to exchange pieces of land. But if you look at the geography of those disputed border areas, there is no much option to offer to each other. And I think that also has to be kept in mind. When we go to the Uzbek and Tajik case, these two borders, Tajik-Uzbek and Tajik-Kyrgyz, I would say very different situations, very different environments.
How?
Very different approach to manage the border.
So how so?
How so? Okay. At both sides of the border, there has been, unlike what you see at the Tajik-Kyrgyz disputed lands, on both sides of the border between Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Uzbekistan, there is a popular wish to cooperate, to come to each other. Mm. Despite all the discourses of nationalism and the state building in the form of border guards, customs, and etc., and the line itself, there is a difference on the communal dynamics, so to say. Now, this is not so much what we see at the Tajik-Kyrgyz border. There, the community interactions, the dynamics between the communities, between the border communities, is quite different. Different in the sense that it's not so much conducive to cooperation. They have to, but it's not that conducive to cooperation.
I'm thinking there has to be a reason behind what the reasoning that you are telling us, Jafar. For example, there is a popular wish on the Uzbek-Tajik side to come together, and there is not. There's opposite situation in Kyrgyz-Tajik border. What makes it opposite?
Well, maybe I can also say something. Well, first, Leah, that there is far more kind of cultural closeness between Tajik and Uzbek. That's for historical reasons, also high degree of intermarriage in these border areas, very great economic kind of interdependency before. So there is kind of real push that we are really kind of one borderland. Very little quest for separation. People felt that separation was artificial. Also, there is no real bad blood between them because they've never been in a situation where they had to divide or compete or that there have been shootings or killings or fights, what we've seen. So they do not have that kind of negative baggage as we have on Kyrgyz-Tajik border. Yeah, because now each side come with a list of grievances against each other. Huh. I would also say, and I'm interested what others are feeling about the fact that Tajik-Uzbek border relations having been markedly improving actually is worse for Kyrgyz-Tajik relations because now Tajik side feels that it has stronger hand. It is not anymore in this kind of cul-de-sac. It has options. It can start trade and transit via Uzbekistan, so they are not as dependent on Kyrgyzstan as a way out. So the government is likely to be perhaps more assertive, more strongly articulating its position, and would be less inclined to discourage the border communities from expressing what they see as their grievances.
That's a very interesting point. Actually, we are almost towards the end of the discussion, Bruce. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, can I just jump in with one thing since we're on the borders there? I would also point out that certainly in the last 15 or 20 years, there's an actual physical separation of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan from Uzbekistan. I mean, if you drive along the border, the Uzbek border, and you're in Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan, there's fences, there's guard posts, checkpoints, plus landmines up in the mountains. So whereas if you're along the Tajik-Kyrgyz border and you're driving along the road, chances are you're just going to go, you're going back and forth and back and forth between the two countries. I mean, you don't even know. I mean, what you drive and you're in Tajikistan, and a kilometer down the road, you're already back in Kyrgyzstan, and then you go back into Tajikistan and back into Kyrgyzstan. That's impossible and it has been for a while along the Uzbek borders. If you get by the fence and you try to go over it, you're going to get shot, probably.
Wow. And just to finalize the discussions and the elements that you mentioned, the problems that you mentioned, and also there's an example of a kind of a improving relationship between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, including the border tension. So what is the solution? How do you see solution coming by? What are the obstacles has to be removed that we find a solution for this? Maybe quick notes from all of you. Madeline, if we can start with you.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think if there were one easy single solution, it would probably have been tried and possibly have been successful already. I think it's a whole series of things. I think there has to be the political will. If we're talking specifically about the Isfara Valley, where this recent tension has been, I think there has to be the political will to really agree the juridical delimitation of the border. Whether that then translates into a kind of formal demarcation process is another thing. But I think juridically, there has to be a legal process precisely to end these kinds of tensions over where exactly the border lies, right? Who does this land belong to, which repeatedly occur whenever there are tensions. But I think that is only, you know, that juridical process is only part of the answer. I think there has to be much more involvement of local communities to really listen to their grievances, to really try to understand why it is that there are these kinds of, you know, I would regard them as really quite existential concerns about being outnumbered demographically, existential concerns about losing your land, existential concerns about having your water supply cut off. And that until those kind of local grievances are really engaged with by the political authorities in the respective capitals, I think there will constantly be this disjuncture between sort of words of you know, brotherly friendship among the respective presidents and perhaps the respective, you know, governors of the regions who go to their Nowruz celebrations and shake hands, and the feeling of an antagonism and grievance at a local level. So I think that really has to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. So Anna, if there are five steps.
I have a solution, but I need supporters.
Okay.
And to push it through.
I
hope that it will help me to mobilize support. My thesis is that this is not a problem which can be solved by drawing borders in this particular Isfara Batken area. We have just to give up on this idea. It is not going to work. There is no fair solution. The only solution is to create a zone of joint jurisdiction between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. That would mean that there will be no physical border. All border structures would be withdrawn. And the perimeter of this special zone, people can have dual citizenship. It's not rocket science. You can have harmonization of laws so that because, of course, land code on both sides is different, but that is something which is manageable. You can harmonize special arrangements, and people would continue living as they lived in Soviet times, and village disputes would be village disputes, but not in an international conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So the important thing is that security structures are withdrawn outside of this area of joint settlement.
Okay. So, Bruce, do you see this as a viable option?
No, I would agree that locally they're going to have to solve this themselves. The only thing I would add to this is that if there was possibly one rule they could do, understanding that it's probably nearly impossible to agree on where the border is, they should have some kind of rule about construction. Most of these conflicts start because one side all of a sudden sees someone's building a fence or blocking off a road or doing something like that, and they didn't know it was happening. So then you get the arguments and everything like that. There's got to be some agreement that no one builds a wall, no one changes the road, no one digs a new canal, anything like that until the communities that live there get together and inform each other. This is my plan. This is the plan that we're going to do. And if they have to argue about it at the meeting, that's preferable to waking up in the morning and seeing that someone has just cut off the road that leads to the cemetery where your grandparents are buried. And so you get rocks and start throwing rocks at them so they stop building the fence.
Mm. Okay, Jaffer, last point from you. So at the points that have been mentioned as a possible solutions, as someone that you have close connection with people on the grounds, do you think any of them works to solve this problem? If not, what is your proposal to resolve this issue?
Sure, I think Anna's idea is very interesting and attractive. However, I think with the new generation coming as community leadership, we would definitely need to have a very clear line that separates one from another. I think the idea in the heads of young people that there can be a joint jurisdiction will not find popularity. Therefore, I would be a proponent of having a very clear line. It does not have to be militarized. It should not be militarized, for sure. And here I would agree with Madeline. But it has to be delimited. I mean, the line has to be delimited. And of course, the focus on community, not only to listen to their grievances, but also to try to work with them as close as possible so that there is a clear realization in the community leadership that violence is not going to make any good for them. A, and B, that neither Tajik side nor Kyrgyz side is going to run away at any time soon. So they have to live with them, with each other, and they have to cooperate with each other.
Well, we couldn't solve this issue in 40 minutes, obviously. So I have to conclude the discussion here, unfortunately. But it was a great discussion. Thank you very much, Jaffer Nematzada, Dushanbe-based researcher, background in border disputes in Central Asia. Also, big thanks goes to Madeline Reeves, senior lecturer of social anthropology at the University of Manchester, and Dr. Anna Matviba, senior visiting fellow at the King's College London, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlag Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time in talks today.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.